Chapter 10. All through her childhood, and up to the middle of her 14th year, Joan had been the most light-hearted creature, and the merriest in the village, with a hop, skip, and jump gait, and a happy and catching laugh. And this disposition, supplemented by her warm and sympathetic nature and frank and winning ways, had made her everybody's pet. As he had been a hot patriot all this time, and sometimes the war news had sobered her spirits, and wrung her heart, and made her acquainted with tears, but always when these interruptions had run their course her spirits rose, and she was her old self again. But now for a whole year, and a half, as he had been mainly grave, not melancholy, but given to thought, abstraction, dreams. She was carrying France upon her heart, and she found the burden not light. I knew that this was her trouble, but others attributed her abstraction to religious ecstasy, for she did not share her thinkings with the village at large, yet gave me glimpses of them, and so I knew, better than the rest, what was absorbing her interest. Many a time the idea crossed my mind, that as he had a secret which she was keeping wholly to herself, as well from me, as from the others. This idea had come to me, because several times she had cut a sentence in two, and changed the subject, when apparently she was on the verge of a revelation of some sort. I was to find this secret out, but not just yet. The day after the conversation which I have been reporting, we were together in the pastures, and fell to talking about France, as usual. For her sake I had always talked hopefully before, but that was mere lying, for really there was not anything to hang a rag of hope for France upon. Now it was such a pain to lie to her, and cost me such shame, to offer this treachery to one so snow pure from lying and treachery, and even from suspicion of such baseness in others, as she was, that I was resolved to face about now, and begin over again, and never insult her more with deception. I started on the new policy by saying one, still opening up with a small lie, of course, for habit is habit, and not to be flung out of the window by any man, but coaxed downstairs a step at a time. Joan, I have been thinking the thing all over last night, and have concluded that we have been in the wrong all this time, that the case of France is desperate, that it has been desperate ever since at Jinkert, and that today it is more than desperate, it is hopeless. I did not look her in the face while I was saying it. It could not be expected of a person to break her heart, to crush her hope with a so frankly brutal speech as that, without one charitable soft place in it. It seemed a shameful thing, and it was. But when it was out, the weight gone, and my conscience rising to the surface, I glanced at her face to see the result. There was none to see. At least none, that I was expecting. There was a barely perceptible suggestion of wonder in her serious eyes, but that was all. And she said, in her simple and placid way, "The case of France hopeless? Why should you think that? Tell me. It is a most pleasant thing to find that what you thought would inflict a hurt upon one whom you honor has not done it." I was relieved now, and could say all my say without any furtivenesses and without embarrassment. So I began. Let us put sentiment and patriotic illusions aside, and look at the facts in the face. What do they say? They speak as plainly as the figures in a merchant's account book. One has only to add the two columns up to see that the French house is bankrupt, that one half of its property is already in the English sheriff's hands, and the other half in nobody's except those of irresponsible raiders and robbers confessing allegiance to nobody. Our king is shut up with his favorites, and fools in inglorious idleness and poverty in a narrow little patch of the kingdom, a sort of back lot, as one may say, and has no authority there or anywhere else, hasn't a farthing to his name, nor a regiment of soldiers. He is not fighting, he is not intending to fight, he means to make no further resistance. In truth, there is but one thing that he is intending to do: give the whole thing up, pitch his crown into the sewer, and run away to Scotland. There are the facts. Are they correct? Yes, they are correct. Then it is as I have said. One needs but to add them together in order to realize what they mean. She asked, in an ordinary, level tone. What that the case of France is hopeless. Necessarily. In face of these facts, doubt of it is impossible. How can you say that? How can you feel like that? How can I? How could I think, or feel in any other way, in the circumstances? Joan, with these fatal figures before you, have you really any hope for France, really and actually? Hope, oh, more than that. France will win her freedom and keep it. Do not doubt it. It seemed to me that her clear intellect must surely be clouded today. It must be so, or she would see that those figures could mean only one thing. Perhaps if I marshaled them again she would see. So I said, Joan, your heart, which worships France, is beguiling your head. You are not perceiving the importance of these figures. Here I want to make a picture of them, hurry on the ground with a stick. Now, this rough outline is France. Through its middle, east and west, I draw a river. Yes, the Loire. Now then, this whole northern half of the country is in the tight grip of the English. Yes. And this whole southern half is really in nobody's hands at all, as our king confesses by meditating desertion and flight to a foreign land. England has armies here. Opposition is dead. She can assume full possession whenever she may choose. In very truth, all France is gone. France is already lost. France has ceased to exist. What was France is now but a British province. Is this true? Her voice was low, and just touched with emotion, but distinct. Yes, it is true. Very well. Now at this clinching fact, and surely the sum is complete. When have French soldiers won a victory? Scotch soldiers, under the French flag, have won a barren fight or two a few years back, but I am speaking of French ones. Since 8,000 Englishmen nearly annihilated 60,000 Frenchmen a dozen years ago at Agincourt, French courage has been paralyzed. And so it is a common saying today, that if you confront 50 French soldiers with 5 English ones, the French will run. It is a pity, but even these things are true. Then certainly the day for hoping is past. I believed the case would be clear to her now. I thought it could not fail to be clear to her, and that she would say, herself, that there was no longer any ground for hope. But I was mistaken, and disappointed also. She said, without any doubt in her tone, France will rise again. You shall see. Rise? With this burden of English armies on her back. She will cast it off. She will trample it underfoot. This with spirit. Without soldiers to fight with? The drums will summon them. They will answer, and they will march. March to the rear, as usual? No, to the front, ever to the front, always to the front. You shall see. And the pauper king? He will mount his throne, he will wear his crown. Well, of a truth this makes one's head dizzy. Why, if I could believe that in 30 years from now the English domination would be broken, and the French monarch's head find itself hooped with a real crown of sovereignty, both will have happened before 2 years are sped. Indeed? And who is going to perform all these sublime impossibilities? God. It was a reverent low note, but it rang clear. What could have put those strange ideas in her head? This question kept running in my mind during 2 or 3 days. It was inevitable that I should think of madness. What other way was there to account for such things? Grieving and brooding over the woes of France had weakened that strong mind, and filled it with fantastic phantoms. Yes, that must be it. But I watched her, and tested her, and it was not so. Her eye was clear and sane, her ways were natural, her speech direct, and to the point. No, there was nothing the matter with her mind. It was still the soundest in the village and the best. She went on thinking for others, planning for others, sacrificing herself for others, just as always before. She went on ministering to her sick, and to her poor, and still stood ready to give the wayfarer her bed, and content herself with the floor. There was a secret somewhere, but madness was not the key to it. This was plain. Now the key did presently come into my hands, and the way that it happened was this. You have heard all the world talk of this matter which I am about to speak of, but you have not heard an eyewitness talk of it before. I was coming from over the ridge. One day it was the 15th of May, 28, and when I got to the edge of the oak forest, and was about to step out of it upon the turfy open space in which the haunted beech tree stood, I happened to cast a glance from cover. First then I took a step backward, and stood in the shelter and concealment of the foliage. For I had caught sight of Joan, and thought I would devise some sort of playful surprise for her. Think of it, that trivial conceit was neighbor, with but a scarcely measurable interval of time between, to an event destined to endure forever in histories and songs. The day was overcast, and all that grassy space wherein the tree stood lay in a soft rich shadow. Joan sat on a natural seat formed by gnarled great roots of the tree. Her hands lay loosely, one reposing in the other, in her lap. Her head was bent a little toward the ground, and her air was that of one who is lost to thought, steeped in dreams, and not conscious of herself, or of the world. And now I saw a most strange thing, for I saw a white shadow come slowly gliding along the grass toward the tree. It was of grand proportions, a robed form, with wings, and the whiteness of this shadow was not like any other whiteness that we know of, except it be the whiteness of lightnings. But even the lightnings are not so intense as it was, for one can look at them without hurt, whereas this brilliance I was so blinding, that in pained my eyes, and brought the water into them. I uncovered my head, perceiving that I was in the presence of something not of this world. My breath grew faint and difficult, because of the terror and the awe that possessed me. Another strange thing. The wood had been silent, smitten with that deep stillness which comes when a storm cloud darkens a forest, and the wild creatures lose heart and are afraid. But now all the birds burst forth into song, and the joy, the rapture, the ecstasy of it was beyond belief, and was so eloquent and so moving, withal, that it was plain it was an act of worship. With the first note of those birds, Joan cast herself upon her knees, and bent her head low, and crossed her hands upon her breast. As he had not seen the shadow yet, had the song of the birds told her it was coming? It had that look to me. Then the like of this must have happened before. Yes, there might be no doubt of that. The shadow approached Joan slowly, the extremity of it reached her, flowed over her, clothed her in its awful splendor. And that immortal light her face, only humanly beautiful before, became divine, flooded with that transforming glory her mean peasant habit was become like to the raiment of the sun-clothed children of God as we see them thronging the terraces of the throne in our dreams and imaginings. Presently she rose and stood, with her head still bowed a little, and with her arms down and the ends of her fingers lightly laced together in front of her. And standing so, all drenched with that wonderful light, and yet apparently not knowing it, she seemed to listen, but I heard nothing. After a little she raised her head, and looked up as one might look up toward the face of a giant, and then clasped her hands, and lifted them high, imploringly, and began to plead. I heard some of the words. I heard her say, "But I am so young, oh, so young to leave my mother and my home, and go out into the strange world, to undertake a thing so great. Ah, how can I tag with men, be comrade with men? Soldiers! It would give me over to insult, and rude usage, and contempt. How can I go to the great wars, and lead armies? I, a girl, and ignorant of such things, knowing nothing of arms, nor how to mount a horse, nor ride it. Yet if it is commanded," her voice sank a little, and was broken by sobs, and I made out no more of her words. Then I came to myself. I reflected that I had been intruding upon a mystery of God, and what might my punishment be. I was afraid, and went deeper into the wood. Then I carved a mark in the bark of a tree, saying to myself, "It may be that I am dreaming, and have not seen this vision at all. I will come again, when I know that I am awake and not dreaming, and see if this mark is still here. Then I shall know." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.